Wittgenstein's razor. If I had to say what the single most important contribution Wittgenstein made to philosophy was, it would have to be to have revived the animal in us. The animal that is there in every fiber of our human being, and therefore also in our thinking and reasoning. This means it's pushing us to realize that we are animals not only genealogically, but as evolved human beings, whether neonate or language-possessing, civilized, law-abiding, fully-fledged adults, constitutionally and in everything we do, still fundamentally animals. Wittgenstein's evocation of the animal in us is strewn more or less implicitly throughout his philosophy, but it is clearly articulated in Uncertainty, where he says he wants to conceive of our basic certainty as, quote, something that lies beyond being justified or unjustified, as it were, as something animal, end of quote. By this he means as something instinctive, thought-free, reflex-like. And this animal state is applied to us also in our acquisition of language. Quote, I want to regard man here as an animal, as a primitive being to which one grants instinct but not ratiocination, as a creature in a primitive state. Any logic good enough for a primitive means of communication needs no apology from us. Language did not emerge from some kind of ratiocination. And also in our grasping of the world's furniture. I quote again from Uncertainty. Children do not learn that books exist, that armchairs exist, etc., etc. They learn to fetch books, sit in armchairs, etc., etc. Later, questions about the existence of things do, of course, arise. Is there such a thing as a unicorn, and so on? But such a question is possible only because, as a rule, no corresponding question presents itself. For how does one know how to set about satisfying oneself of the existence of unicorns? How did one learn the method for determining whether something exists or not? End of quote. Well, one does not learn a method of figuring out whether something exists or not until a question presents itself. And a question does not normally present itself as to whether I or the chair I am sitting in exists. It does normally present itself about unicorns or about whether there are chairs in the next room. What Wittgenstein is doing here is deproblematizing or deintellectualizing what we have problematized and intellectualized. There is no question or problem about existence until there is a question or problem about it. Quote, so one must know that the objects whose names one teaches a child by extensive definition exists? Why must one know they do? Isn't it enough that experience doesn't later show the opposite? For why should the language game rest on some kind of knowledge? Does a child believe that milk exists? Or does it know that milk exists? Does a cat know that a mouse exists? End of quote. If a cat doesn't need to know that a mouse exists before chasing it, nor does a child need to know that milk exists before drinking it. And nor does an adult need to know that a house exists before entering it. For Wittgenstein, grasping the world is by default done primitively, not epistemically or indeed propositionally. Here, perception, be it of the milk, the mouse, or the house, is, as Dan Hutter puts it, not contentful, but enabling. And contrary to the widely endorsed thesis that cognition always and everywhere involves content, Wittgenstein regards cognition as always and everywhere involving man as an animal, as a creature in a primitive state. He insists that we cannot make a move or have a thought that does not stem from the animal in us, and that it is only after that primitive start that cognition can have content. This translates into saying that, for Wittgenstein, at the beginning is the deed. Not the word, not the proposition, but the deed, action. He writes, language, I want to say, is a refinement. In the beginning was the deed. End of quote. And the beginning here is also the term primitive, whenever used by Wittgenstein or myself in this paper, is not to be understood only ontogenetically and phylogenetically, but also logically. So, not only at the beginning of an individual human life, or at the beginning of the human species, but logically. This is where inactivism comes in. Action in Wittgenstein is everywhere. Not only at the origin of human thought and language, but the origin of any thought or utterance. That is, it has regained its rightful place in the description of our human mindedness. He placed Userbein inflated intellect and brain in the form of content, propositions, representations, traces, engrams, or intelligent neurons. Action, and not any of these, is for Wittgenstein at the logical foundation of thought. This is not merely to say that we need to be alive to think, or that thinking is a form of acting, but that much, not all, but much of what we have always regarded as thinking is in fact acting or behavior. Acting, however, that looks like thought because we, philosophers, have put it into words. This includes such things as our basic beliefs, spontaneous utterances, and rules of grammar. Now, of course, all of these can be put into sentences, or if you like, propositions. But what Wittgenstein has shown is that they do not stem from propositions, and so they do not start out as any kind of content. So two things I'd like to do here. One is to briefly survey two of the topics that Wittgenstein has inactivized, as it were. The other is to stress that this inactivism is not anything added, but rather what is left when our superfluous, unsubstantiated, explanation-hungry enhancements have been erased from the straightforward picture of human action and cognition. The two topics I will look at are basic beliefs and memory, thereby hoping to give an idea of how Wittgenstein's razor has pared off some of the excess in epistemology and philosophy of mind. But before I do this, I'd like to briefly enumerate a few of the other ways in which Wittgenstein helped emphasize the primacy of action, together with the superfluity in basic or primitive cases of propositions and cognition in his account of mind, language, and action. We can start with his signature phrase, meaning is use. Meaning is the product of our operating with words. And so, the meaning of a word, he writes, is described simply by describing its use. That is how we operate with that word. And so it goes for understanding. As Wittgenstein writes, we think there must be something going on in one's mind for one to understand the word plant. We are inclined to say that what we mean by one's understanding the word is a process of the mind. There is a way out of the difficulty of explaining what understanding is if we take understanding a word to mean roughly being able to use it. The point of this explanation is to replace understanding a word by being able to use a word, which is not so easily thought of as denoting an inner activity. In most cases, the word understand is used to mean being able to do so and so. When a man understands an order, it is true that often certain pictures are present to his mind, though often not. End of quote. Now add to this his view of rule following in terms of making a move rather than a judgment. To follow a rule is to do something. Calculating, using mathematical rules or mechanical activities, like making moves that one was trained to perform. Rules of mathematics are akin to orders or commands that impart technique. The mathematical proposition says to me, proceed like this. It determines, lays down a path for us, he writes in the Remarks Foundation of Mathematics. And in the Ambrose lectures, I quote, the expressions being able to, understanding how to, knowing how to go on, have practically the same grammars. So Wittgenstein's razor is seen at work on the subjects of perception, belief, feelings, sensations, emotions, and of course action. Wherever we have traditionally inserted an intellectual process or state, be it a thought, a description, interpretation, an inference, a judgment, or a justified true belief, that turns out upon scrutiny to be superfluous. Here are some examples, which I quote. The squirrel does not infer by induction that it is going to need stores next winter as well. And no more do we need a law of induction to justify our actions or our predictions. You don't need any knowledge to find a smell repulsive. It is not as if he had only indirect, while I have internal direct evidence for my mental state. Rather, he has evidence for it, but I do not. Whether I know something depends on whether the evidence backs me up or contradicts me. For to say one knows one has a pain means nothing. If I let my gaze wander around a room and suddenly it lights on an object of a striking red color, and I say, red, that is not a description. My attitude towards him is an attitude towards a soul. I am not of the opinion that he has a soul. We can see from their actions that people believe certain things. These quotes were taken from Uncertainty, Last Writings, Volume 1 and 2, and P.I. And Wittgenstein has drawn our attention to the enacted nature of spontaneous first-person psychological utterances, showing that here too words are deeds, adding a new twist to the notion of speech acts. Quote, the words I am happy are a bit of the behavior of joy. The exclamation, I'm longing to see him, may be called an act of expecting, but I can utter the same words as a result of self-observation. Are the words I am afraid a description of a state of mind? It depends on the game they are in. Also for Wittgenstein, meaning, language acquisition, and concept formation are rooted in instinctive reactions and gestures, and further developed through training and enculturation. We'll see tomorrow how this helps destabilize the picture of an innate mental grammar by replacing it with a grammar that is rooted in our primitive reactions and transmitted socioculturally. Meaning, believing, thinking, understanding, reasoning, calculating, learning, following rules, remembering, intending, expecting, longing. There is hardly anything traditionally thought to be emergent from, underwritten by, or reducible to a mental process or state that Wittgenstein is not subjected to the razor of enactivism. That is, shown to be primitively embodied or enacted rather than originating in propositions, theories of minds, or ghostly processes. Now this may sound like behaviorism, but it isn't. As Peter Hacker aptly sums up, behaviorism was right about some matters. Logical behaviorism was right to insist that there is an internal relation between mental attributes and behavior. The criteria for ascribing mental attributes to others consist in their behavior in the circumstances of life. Where it was wrong was to suppose that the mental is reducible to behavior and dispositions to behave. Ontological behaviorism was right to emphasize that language learning is based on training and that it presupposes common behavioral reactions and responses. It was right to conceive of language learning as learning new forms of behavior, learning how to do things with words. It was correct to conceive of understanding in terms of abilities and dispositions rather than as a hidden mental state or process. But the behaviorists were sorely mistaken to suppose that the mental is a fiction. One can think and feel without showing it, and one can exhibit thoughts and feelings without having them. Avowals of experience are indeed a form of behavior, but what they avow is not behavior. End of quote. So not behaviorism, but enactivism. I remember my first paper at Kirchberg in 1997. Before I'd ever heard the term enactivism, I don't even know if it was on the market yet, that paper was entitled The Enacted Nature of Basic Beliefs, and I was taken to task by my audience for using the word enacted as implying that there was something there preceding the enactment that was going to be enacted. So I dropped the word and went on talking about certainty in action and logic in action. But I shouldn't have been so quickly discouraged. The word needn't be, and indeed has not been, thus understood. Wittgenstein is an enactivist through and through, indeed perhaps the first enactivist, though a bit can also be made there by Aristotle. But let me now turn to Wittgenstein and basic beliefs. Uncertainty is Wittgenstein's attempt, prompted by G.E. Moore's problematic conclusion in Proof of an External World, to uncover the nature of our basic beliefs. As he ponders that nature, we see Wittgenstein consider various possibilities. He thinks of these basic beliefs in propositional terms and in pictorial terms, but his ultimate depiction of our basic beliefs is as ways of acting. Let's briefly see how he gets there. Recall Moore's short list of truisms, of which he says, I know with certainty to be true. I quote from Moore. There exists at present a living human body, which is my body. This body was born at a certain time in the past and has existed continuously ever since. Among the things which have formed part of its environment have been large numbers of other living human bodies. The earth has existed also for many years before my body was born. Here is a hand, and so on. Now, Wittgenstein considers these truisms and others an uncertainty, such as if someone's arm is cut off, it will not grow again, cats don't grow on trees, I am sitting here. There are, he says, countless such general empirical propositions that count as certain for us. He realizes, however, that our certainty vis-à-vis these apparent empirical propositions, their standing fast for us, or not doubting them, is not due to reasoning or verification, to our having empirically or rationally exhausted all avenues of doubt on their behalf, but to our not regarding them as susceptible of doubt in the first place. Our basic certainty is not of the order of justification or reflection, or indeed of truth, and is therefore not susceptible of mistake, doubt, or falsification. For where no epistemic route was followed, no epistemic fault is possible. I know how to ascertain that I have two coins in my pocket, writes Wittgenstein, but I cannot ascertain that I have two hands, because I cannot doubt it. To be certain here means to be unwaveringly and yet non-cognitively poised on something that enables us to think, speak, or act meaningfully. That something is grammar. Wittgenstein comes to realize that Moore's truisms, though they resemble or have the form of empirical or epistemic propositions, are in fact expressions of bounds of sense or rules of grammar at par with 2 plus 2 equals 4. He writes, I want to say, the physical game is just as certain as the arithmetical. If one doesn't marvel at the fact that the propositions of arithmetic, for example, the multiplication tables, are absolutely certain, then why should one be astonished at the proposition, this is my hand, is so equally? And precisely because these truisms are not justified true beliefs, he rebukes Moore for claiming that he knows them. I quote, I should like to say Moore does not know what he asserts he knows, but it stands fast for him, as also for me. Regarding it as absolutely solid is part of our method of doubt and inquiry. Which is to say, for Wittgenstein, part of our grammar. Moore's truisms, then, express not objects of knowledge, but bounds of sense, that which enables us to get to knowledge. In a well-known metaphor, Wittgenstein uses the image of hinges that must stand fast in order for the door of inquiry to turn. Now, some of these bounds of sense or rules of grammar are, as Wittgenstein says, they're like our life. They are a natural, animal-like, or instinctual certainty that need never be taught or even articulated. For instance, humans have bodies. There exist people other than myself. Humans cannot vanish into thin air. Here, to be certain does not imply that one can understand the sentences I've just pronounced. A one-year-old child not yet in possession of language shows that she is endowed with such certainties by using her body, interacting with others, running away from a barking dog rather than sitting there waiting to vanish. Other hinges, for example, this is what we call a table, or people sometimes lie, are acquired. Yet, like all rules, they are acquired not empirically or epistemically, but through training or repeated exposure. Yet whatever their origin, whether they be natural or second nature certainties, all hinges function as grammatical rules. They, quote, form the foundation of all operating with thoughts. Wittgenstein, however, warns us against thinking of this grammar in propositional terms. He writes, giving grounds, justifying the evidence, comes to an end. But the end is not certain propositions striking us immediately as true, i.e., it is not a kind of seeing on our part. It is our acting which lies at the bottom of the language game. So grammar is seen as belonging to the realm of acting. Hinge or basic certainty is not a matter of propositions or intellection at all, but takes the form of spontaneous acting in the certainty of an innumerable array of things. It is much like an unself-conscious know-how. My life shows that I know or am certain that there is a chair over there or a door and so on. I tell a friend, for example, take that chair over there, shut the door, and so on. So although I've never uttered or thought the words chairs are for sitting on or doors can be opened and closed, what I say about and do with chairs and doors show that I have grasped these conceptual features. And nor is the certainty of my grasp a conceptual or propositional one. Rather, quote, it is just like directly taking hold of something as I take hold of my towel without having doubts. And yet this direct taking hold corresponds to a sureness, not to a knowing. End of quote. This sureness, which unlike knowing, does not originate in doubt or hesitation, and which has the characteristics of a reflex action, of an automatism, of an instinct, is altogether foreign to thought. and this thoughtlessness, that which lays the basis for thought and is therefore itself not a thought, is also a wordlessness. It goes without saying. I believe that I had great-grandparents, that the people who gave themselves out as my parents really were my parents, etc. This belief may never have been expressed, even the thought that it was so never thought. OC 159. Such is the enacted nature of grammar and basic beliefs that they do not even as such bear saying within the stream of the language game, but only in heuristic situations. That is, in situations where rules of grammar are transmitted through drill or training to a child, a disturbed adult, or a foreign speaker, or in philosophical discussion. To articulate grammatical rules within the stream of the language game, that is, in the flow of ordinary discourse, is to articulate bounds of sense as if they were informative statements. If I were to say to the cloakroom attendant as I hand him my token, "This is a token," he would look at me puzzled. Our shared certainty that this is a token can only show itself in our normal transaction with the token. It cannot qua certainty be meaningfully said. That this is a token is the ineffable hinge upon which his looking for the number on the token revolves. To say a hint within the language game invariably arrests the game. Conversely, think of the fluidity of the game poised on its invisible hinges. I hand the attendant my token. He glances at the number on it and fetches my coat. Our foundational certainty is operative only in action, not in words. The hinge is, writes Wittgenstein, fixed and removed from the traffic. OC 210. That is, it enables, but does not belong to the language game. Hinge certainty is an embodied or enacted certainty, exhibiting itself in the ongoing smoothness of our normal, basic operating in the world. More saying, "I know that here is a hand," conveying no certainty that was not already visible in his speaking about his hand, in his ostensibly showing it to his audience, or simply in his unselfconsciously using it. Or hinge certainty that tables, chairs, pots, and pans don't think shows itself in our treating them as unthinking, inanimate objects. Or hinge certainty that there are physical objects shows itself in our reaching out to pick a flower, but not a thought. Hinges are grammatical rules, but they are rules in action, logic in action. Quote, "That is to say, it belongs to the logic of our scientific investigations that certain things are indeed not doubted. Our life, our deeds show that we do not, cannot doubt some things if we are to make sense. Certainty here is not an option. It belongs to the logic of our investigations. That is, if we were indeed to doubt, it would not be a manifestation of uncertainty, but of nonsense or madness." Wittgenstein's conclusion on uncertainty is that our basic certainty is logical, logically ineffable, and enacted. I have elsewhere called this a logical pragmatism. As he'd already suspected in the remarks on the foundations of mathematics, quote, "The limits of empiricism are not assumptions unguaranteed or intuitively known to be correct. They are ways in which we act." End of quote. And so with uncertainty, foundationalism sheds its old skin. Where epistemologists have always thought of our basic beliefs as proposition, Wittgenstein sees them as rules of grammar or bounds of sense that manifest themselves as ways of acting. These rules can be articulated into sentences, as I've been doing, and as Wittgenstein does in Uncertainty. But such articulation is effected only for heuristic purposes. The problem is, once verbalized, these rules of grammar misleadingly look like empirical propositions, conclusions that we come to from experience. This resemblance has confused philosophers and disconcerts Wittgenstein himself throughout much of Uncertainty. But he does come to the realization that we have yet again been mystified by the appearance of language. And he writes, "I am inclined to believe that not everything that has the form of an empirical proposition is one." He thereby solves the problem that occupied more and plagued epistemology, that of the foundation of knowledge. What philosophers have traditionally called basic beliefs cannot, on pain of infinite regret, themselves be propositional beliefs. Rather, they are animal or unreflective ways of acting, which once formulated look like propositional beliefs. It is this misleading appearance that leads philosophers to believe that at the foundation of thought is yet more thought. Wittgenstein's conception of hinge certainty enables us to rid ourselves of what Britt Harrison has dubbed the propositional presumption, the misguided conviction that propositions are indispensable to our grasp of the world. Having in PI put the animal back in language, in resisting the temptation to underpin knowledge with yet more knowledge, Wittgenstein allows the animal to surface in epistemology, making clear for philosophy at large, and not only for epistemology, that thought is prefaced by thoughtlessness that has been interpreted as thought, by spontaneity, automatism, rule, reflex, and instinct. He shows that we do not start with judgments or propositions, but with animal actions and reactions that evolve into content-laden thought and action. We do not go from proposition to deed, but vice versa, from a non-reflective grasp to a sophisticated pondering, from doing to judging and thinking. It seems that it is our ambition to explain, to gain firmness and hold on the phenomenon, that leads us to turn ways of acting into tacit beliefs and basic propositions. In our picture of memory, Wittgenstein discerns yet another instance of our attempts to solidify, fix, incarnate, or reify what deploys itself in our ways of acting. So, as regards memory, Wittgenstein wants to clear the scene of the persistent notions of memory traces and memory storage. He writes, "I saw this man years ago. Now I've seen him again. I recognize him. I remember his name. And why does there have to be a cause of this remembering in my nervous system? Why must something or other, whatever it may be stored up there in any form? Why must the trace have been left behind? Why should there not be a psychological regularity to which no physiological regularity corresponds? If this upsets our concepts of causality, then it is high time they were upset." End of quote. Well, it's passages like this that have earned Wittgenstein the label behaviorist, and that continue to earn him the reputation of a radical anti-physicalist. And yet Wittgenstein's intention here, or ever, is not to reject a psychophysical correlation between the brain and our mental activities. On the contrary, he assumes such a correlation. As he says, quote, "If I talk or write, there is, I assume, a system of impulses going out from my brain and correlated with my spoken or written thoughts." What Wittgenstein does reject is a psychophysical parallelism, that is, an isomorphic correlation between brain processes and thoughts and memories. Quote, "Nothing seems more possible to me than that people someday will come to the definite opinion that there is no copy in either the physiological or the nervous systems which corresponds to a particular thought or a particular idea or memory." End of quote. So, of course, remembering is causally dependent on the brain, in the trivial sense of the physiological necessity of having a brain in order to experience anything at all. It is causally dependent on brain processes or structures. But it does not follow that these structures are representations of particular memories stored and encoded in the brain that we could read off. We should stop presupposing that, as Toth and Reed put it, by describing the structure of the brain, we are explaining the function of the mind. That would be conflating brain reading with mind reading. And to do this is to make a category mistake. The brain is a material object, the mind a capacity. It is also to conflate retention with physical storage. The brain is a mechanical enabler. It is not ipso facto the storehouse and codifier of our memories. Whatever the event does leave behind in the organism, writes Wittgenstein, it isn't the memory. As Stéphane Chauvier notes, that a lesion in the part of her brain prevents an individual from recognizing certain familiar faces informs us about the neural conditions required for someone to recognize a face. But the recognition of a face is not itself a neuronal process. That is to say, some neural structures are causal conditions for our ability to remember or recognize, but they are not remembering or recognizing. As well as in this misleading view of causality, which conflates causal conditions with causal representations, also a narrow view of causality contributes to our misconception of memory. We are loath to envisage a causation that is not physiological, so that we not only mistakenly take the brain to be recording what we see in an isomorphic trace, we also see this trace as having an activating function. It acts as mediator and activator between the original event and our ability to call it to mind. So that every time we remember an event, besides representing it, the trace is also supposed to select, decode, and activate the memory. The notion of memory traces seems to explain the source of memory, but all it does is offer the semblance of a physiological grip on a seemingly mystifying faculty. And so we are left with what Norman Malcolm calls an illusion of explanation. Wittgenstein's diagnosis of our need to postulate a physiological mediator between mind and brain is that action at a distance is to us a repugnant idea. But in fact, asks Wittgenstein, quote, why should not the initial internal states of a system be connected by a natural law which does not cover the intermediary state? Indeed, in cases like someone's excessive ambition causing their loneliness, or greed causing someone to become corrupt, no physiological connection or mediation or causation obtains, though many psychological or intentional connections do. So what before Wittgenstein is hardly envisaged is that we make the connection. Memory is an ability, and it is an ability that living beings have, not traces or brains. It is not, quote, some feature of our memory image that tells us the time to which it belongs. If memory shows us the past, how does it show us that it is the past? It does not show us the past, any more than our senses show us the present. It takes remembering to tell us that this is past, end of quote. And of course, remembering is done by a person. To accept the hypothesis of unconscious monitoring mechanisms is to fall prey to the homunculus fallacy. That is, to attribute intentionality, that is, conscious selection, decision, rejection, to an unconscious process. Nothing is being gained, since we find ourselves as an unconscious made up of the same elements as a conscious subject, and what we had invoked to explain conscious memory now itself requires an explanation. Memory cannot rely on such things as mental representations or memory engrams, because there is no homunculus there to interpret them and to provide memory traces with their past tense. Wittgenstein further counters the pervasive conception of memory as storage and retrieval by insisting that there is no one conception, picture, or metaphor that will render the multifarious ways in which we remember something. He writes, different sorts of memories are to be distinguished. One kind passes in time, cinematographically. Another is like an image given all at once, but afar off. And we must not fail to take account of the kind of memory which consists in remembering a poem or tune rather than some event of the past. In these cases, to remember it means to be able to reproduce it. End of quote. So whereas we are inclined to believe that saying or doing something cannot be all there is to memory, that it leaves out the essential feature of the mental process of memory and gives us only an accessory feature, Wittgenstein unprecedentedly affirms that words, as well as gestures, can constitute remembering. They don't always, but they can. Remembering can amount to doing something, such as reciting a poem by heart or fetching someone's key for them. Recognizing someone can consist in saying hello to them in words, gestures, facial expressions, and so on. He writes, remembering then isn't at all the mental process that one imagined at first sight. If I say rightly, I remember it, the most varied things may happen, perhaps even just that I say it. If someone remembers his hope, on the whole, he is not therefore remembering his behavior, nor even necessarily his thoughts. He says that at that time he hoped. End of quote. Now, these hardly resemble mental consultations of mental archives. Wittgenstein is not, however, suggesting that there can be no mental process of remembering. If you ask me when the last time was I had chocolate fondue, I would have to stop and think about it, and so there would be a mental process of remembering. Nothing mysterious here. I would be doing the remembering, the deliberate calling to mind of certain moments in my past. What Wittgenstein rejects is only that peculiar mental state or process which is thought to necessarily occur along with or in advance of the expressions of memory. On Wittgenstein's view, we are warranted in speaking of a memory act, if by it we do not mean a ghostly, amorphous mental event that must precede and cause an expression or act of recall. Wittgenstein's major contribution to the elucidation of the concept of memory is his discrediting the picture of memory as information storage and boldly replacing it with the idea that memory is nothing but an ability, and that in some context remembering amounts to a way of acting, that is, to an act or expression which does not result from introspection or retrospection. The input of context is essential here. What gives a gesture or an utterance their mnemonic status is not any property they may have or any mental representations they are based on, but their context. It is context that makes an act, for example, a smile or a nod, a memory act rather than, say, an act of politeness. As Malcolm suggests, a smile and a greeting would reveal recognition in one context, but just friendliness in another. Wittgenstein gives various examples of remembering is often prompted by or embedded in certain acts, as in this passage from his lectures on philosophical psychology. I draw a curve on paper when the man speaks. When I trace the curve again, I can repeat the sentence, but the curve can't be read as a code. Although retracing the curve is here a necessary condition for recall, Wittgenstein insists that it is not any representative nature the curve would have acquired that makes it thus necessary. The curve can't be read as a code. Nor would Wittgenstein have agreed with extended mind theorists that such examples of situated and embodied memory are merely cognitive scaffolding, or that they are best seen as alien but complementary to the brain style of storage and computation, as does Andy Clark. For Wittgenstein, retracing the curve is, along with being a minimally healthy human being, a sufficient condition for recall. In a similar passage, he adds, these jottings would not be a rendering of the text, not a translation, so to speak, in another symbolism. The text would not be stored up in the jottings. And why should it be stored up in our nervous system? End of quote. Wittgenstein then helps us move away from the distorted picture of memory as the storage and retrieval of reified memories towards a conception of memory as something that can be situated, contextualized, external, and in action. My remembering something can be in the form of a mental picture, but it can also have the form of a gesture or a sentence. Remembering can amount to something I say or do. This helps discredit the picture of mental phenomena as essentially representations internal to the brain, and sheds light on the mental as an ability whose manifestations can be as much in what we do as in what we think, but never in what our brain does or thinks. I have shown elsewhere that Wittgenstein has influenced some current neuropsychological conceptions of memory, but the struggle is still uphill. Also, the notion of extended memory, for better or for worse, owes something to Wittgenstein. But it is in Eric Mind's conception of extensive memory that I believe Wittgenstein is best present. Dissatisfied with the notion of extended memory because it remains grounded in an internalist and representational view of memory, Mayan introduces the notion of extensive memory, according to which remembering is a contextualized capacity to make the past matter in current activities. Here, representations are eliminated, not accommodated. What is traditionally explained in terms of explicit representations is explained in terms of interactions. Memory is seen not as a matter of storing and retrieving representations, but as a particular way of interacting with the environment. My own efforts in this field have focused on how Wittgenstein's work encourages us to stop treating automatic behavior as behavior that is remembered. What neuropsychologists have called non-declarative, procedural, or implicit memory seems to me nothing but automatic or habitual ways of acting or speaking that are not reliant on memory, though of course they can initially have been, as when a child first tries to tie her shoelaces and seeks to remember what she's supposed to do. So that so-called implicit memory is no memory at all. There is another cognitive layer paired off by Wittgenstein's razor. I gave a paper on Wittgenstein and memory to neuropsychologists at the International Conference on Memory in New York last year. And I was delighted and relieved to see that I wasn't booed. My audience was not at all dismissive of what I had to say. Interestingly, however, the main question put to me was, if not engrams, which are transient or enduring changes in our brain that result from encoding an experience, if not engrams, what would neuropsychologists working on memory be left to work with? Well, that's an odd question, for no evidence has ever been found for the existence of engrams. Indeed, Fergus Gregg had in the first plenary cautioned that, I quote, remembering is better thought of as an activity of mind and brain akin to perceiving, and the search for the engram is therefore doomed to failure. But there is also a positive answer here, and it is twofold. Wittgenstein is not taking the brain away from neuropsychologists. He is merely adjusting the target, what it is they should be and should not be looking for in the brain. And also, there is behavior to work on. If, as Craig stresses, remembering is an activity, let's work on that. Which is not to say, as I hope to make clear, that Wittgenstein is championing behaviorism. Now, it might be objected, Wittgenstein can say what he likes, but where's the evidence? As Jesse Prince quips, inactive and embodied approaches are easier to sell than to prove. Well, it is scientists, not philosophers, that base their claims on evidence. What philosophers do is work on more perspicuous, conceptual presentations of how things are. And what Wittgenstein has done is show that we cannot make conceptual sense of basic certainties that start off as propositions and engrams that work like people. But now let me return the question and ask scientists, where is your evidence? I hear there isn't much, and I hear it from the right quarters. Kian Nobre, professor of cognitive neuroscience at the Department of Experimental Psychology at New College, Oxford, director of the Oxford Centre for Human Brain Activity at the Department of Psychiatry, and head of the Brain and Cognition Laboratory at the Department of Experimental Psychology, whose primary objective is to reveal the organizational principles of the neurosystems that support cognitive functions in the human brain, has recently confirmed to me that, much to her chagrin, there has not been found a hint of anything representational or encoded in the brain. No shadow of an isomorphic trace or engram. In short, nothing resembling a realization of the mental in the brain. So I insist we must go micro or subpersonal in our accounts of the mind, when even science is unable to demonstrate that that's the way to go. When even someone like John Searle concedes that there is no micro account available to back up his physicalist claims. I quote him, "A deep understanding of consciousness would require an understanding of how consciousness is caused by and realized in brain structures. Right now, nobody knows the answers to these questions." End of quote. Well, if attention is to be paid by philosophy to science, shouldn't it be to scientific results rather than to scientific hypotheses that seem nourished by a preconception of how things must be? But this doesn't stop Searle from stating what is a hypothesis as unquestionable. He writes, "It is just a plain fact that neuronal processes do cause feelings, and we need to try and understand how." End of quote. Wittgenstein's inactive account of mindedness is informed by unassuming description, not tendentious explanation. It relies not on assumptions unguaranteed and indeed unsubstantiated, but on what is already in plain view, and yet we seem not to understand, because we do not command a clear view of the use of our words. The burden of proof is therefore not on the philosopher, inasmuch as all she does is rearrange what lies open to view, what is always before our eyes, in an effort to give a more perspicuous presentation of it, a new arrangement, which, as Wittgenstein hopes, I quote, "might also give a new direction to scientific investigation," end of quote. Why then, when there are conceptually viable options based on the obvious, and moreover no sign of an engram, a representation, or an intelligent neuron in the brain, should we go micro in any account of ourselves as mindful beings? Even if per impossibile a micro account were available, and I say per impossibile because it seems to me logically impossible that my mental life can be caused by configuration of molecules rather than by fully fledged people, events, and things out there in the world. There's no physical or logical room in those molecules for the world. But again, even if per impossibile a micro account were available, how would it be more adequate or relevant than a Wittgenstein type account? How would it be a more perspicuous presentation of our human form of life? Water is not relevantly reducible to H2O, other than in very limited contexts, such as chemistry classes and labs. We do not think of or refer to as H2O the stuff we go to the beach to splash in, or the stuff we add to our whiskey, or admire in Monet paintings, or pray to the rain god for. Indeed, those of us who pray to the rain god have probably never even heard of H2O. Moreover, not all H2O is water. Some H2O we call ice, other H2O we call steam or vapor. And so if even water is not, except in very limited contexts, relevantly reducible to its molecular configuration, what should our meanings, feelings, and behaviors be? Why should my awareness that I am enjoying the sun or a Chateau Petrus 82, or that I am slowly losing consciousness, be things that I would want to attribute to or thank my molecules for? Or indeed find relevance or adequacy in any account of myself as a minded and social being that would do so. Anyone in their right mind would accept that we cannot think, act, or be without molecules or neurons. But what is the explanatory relevance of neuronal processes for our understanding of ourselves as minded beings, or for our understanding of the nature of institutions, human institutions? As Dan Hutto puts it, something may have to be the case for certain things to happen, but it can be irrelevant to the explanation we need. And I'll just end with this thought from Raymond Gaita. He reminds us that the most fundamental aspect of Wittgenstein's legacy is that we cannot purify our concepts of their embeddedness in human life without being left with only a shadow play of the grammar of serious judgment. That shadow play is reflected, it seems to me, in the dance of neurons and electrons that make up the physicalist's ultimately reduced and therefore dehumanized world. Thank you.